Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Andrew Alden on the show. Andrew is a geologist and geoscience writer who has worked for the U.S. Geological Survey and reported for KQED and Bay Nature. Long fascinated with rocks and landscapes, Alden found inspiration for his debut book, Deep Oakland, in the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake, which, as he writes, ripped the city open and revealed to us its heart and character, end quote. Through his writing, Alden raises awareness for what he calls the deep present, the appreciation of the ancient underpinnings that shape the modern-day surroundings of our daily life. I really enjoyed digging into the geology of Oakland with Andrew, and I know you will too. Let's go meet him. Let's imagine you were doing a presentation before a city council or a group of county supervisors, and you wanted to articulate the importance of using geology to plan the future of a city. How would you make that case?
I've never thought about that, but geology, well, it's in some ways it really, really matters. In Oakland, it really matters because of the Hayward Fault. And that was why I led the book that chapter about the Hayward Fault, because it explains everything. It explains how our landscape was put together, and so that leads to everything else. But it's also the active part of geology. You know, we think of geology as rocks, as quiet things that sit there for millions of years. But geology is a set of actions, a set of forces. And the big one is the tectonics that shaped California all the way at the whole state, you know. And so the big threat is earthquakes. And Oakland, the Hayward Fault also moves without earthquakes. It moves between earthquakes constantly. So by the process called creep. So it's constant, it needs constant maintenance. The water lines that cross it, the roads always need patching and so on. It's always in our face, whether it's, you know, shaking or ripping the ground apart. You know, I think that's where it really starts. And just earthquakes in general, you know, Oakland has a big housing problem. There's people without homes. It's hard to build here. And my stand is that in an earthquake-prone town, we need to build as many new buildings as we can. And they need to hold a lot of people, because when the big one hits, we're going to need every one of those. So, yeah, I think that's where I'd start.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you're saying that.
But as far as, you know, as far as the average citizen goes, the reason I wrote the book Deep Oakland is simply to wake people up, simply to give them something new to see as they travel around town and think about, you know, the place they live.
Well, you know, it's funny you're saying that, because I'm just reading through this graphic novel right now by this economist who kind of likes to stoke controversy. And the title of the graphic novel is Build Baby Build. And it's about increasing the, you know, the building. And he's approaching it from a, you know, zoning and making housing more available, increasing our housing supply so more people can have homes. But then there's also catastrophe and planning for that. Now, before we'll get into the fault lines here in a little bit, but before we go any further, I just wanted to help the audience to understand terms, because I think, you know, at least when I was going through school, geology was part of kind of a sub portion of the life sciences classes I took, but I never took a standalone geology course, you know, and I think in my academic career. So if you were trying to explain just simply, when we say geology, what we're referring to as a discipline here, and in the context of this book, how would you explain what exactly we're talking about?
Well, in the preface of my book, I kind of address that. People think geology is a static subject. It's about fossils and, you know, these weird charts on the wall that you roll down and look at the Permian period and so on. But that's like 100 years old, and within my lifetime, within the last 60 years, the field has been revolutionized. We now have a complete body of understanding that encompasses the whole Earth, from the outer atmosphere to the Earth's core and its whole 4.5 billion year history. And when you learn all that and look around you, there's new stories, there's new ways to tell stories about geology in terms of the mechanics of how the Earth works. And I hope that people tend to get is when we talk about climate change, because that's definitely a part of Earth sciences, the fact that human activity has actually altered the atmosphere. And when we ask about, well, how does the atmosphere work? Well, we go, oh, well, let me tell you about, the rest of the Earth, because it all fits together.
Now, if I know most Californians know at least the term fault or fault lines, are there any other important concepts in geology that the average Californian should know about beyond faults? Because I think earthquakes are a big part of it, and that's maybe where people's geology education stops. What else should they know living in California? What are some important concepts?
Well, we all know about erosion and landslides, and those are universal. We know about volcanoes. California has active volcanoes. They haven't erupted in 100 years, but that's nothing to a volcano. And not so far from Fresno, not so far from Oakland, like 100 miles away, as the crow flies. And things like, well, faults are just important because they interrupt everything. All of our water supplies, for instance, in Los Angeles, Southern California, and the big Northern California cities, they will cross major fault lines, these dams. We understand about dams. When you get into it, geology is all around us.
Now, your book is one of the first books that looked at geology in the context of a city's history, which I found like a fascinating thought experiment. I mean, I've read John McPhee's stuff about California, and so I know that there's been large, books written about larger geographical areas, but yours is the first that I've read was geology about a specific place. Now, Oakland is unique, though. Not every city has such an interesting geological history, or is that incorrect in your mind?
I don't want to speak for other cities, but
Yeah.
when I lived in, I moved to Oakland in 1989 and we had our earthquake, and I know about geology, but my mind was elsewhere. My mind was in journal articles, working on journal papers, and just in interesting places like the Himalayas and Antarctica and Hawaii. And that's the trouble. That's the same thing that happens to a lot of researchers. And like, for instance, at Fresno State, you've got a very good faculty there, but they're all working up in the Sierra Nevada looking at the Mesozoic plutons and so on. That's their specialty. So it took living in Oakland for a couple of decades to approach it from as a citizen. And when I did that, I realized, the more I got to know the place and the more I learned about its history, it was just, I thought this is a really rich story. And I started, speaking to groups too, because of my long-running Oakland geology blog, which I've been writing since 2007. And so it just occurred to me, there's enough richness on both sides of the story, in history and in geology, to put a book together. And like you say, it's not common. I did a little search when I was starting out, and the one I knew about already was there's a book by some geologists about the city of Rome, and there's a human history that goes back thousands of years, and the aqueducts and so on and so on, and I realized that Oakland has equivalent richness, but Fresno does too. I just can't tell you all the details. San Francisco does. Sacramento, Los Angeles, every major city. New York City is amazing. There's stuff to tell about all those places. Someone
Well,
else is going to do those. I've done Oakland and I'm going to move on, but I do think it will inspire other authors. I think every retired geologist, maybe you've lived in a You've worked at your local college for a whole career, and now just look around your city and see if there's a story you can put together for your fellow citizens, not just your grad students.
Yeah, fantastic. One of the things you brought up in your preface that was an insight for me was the connection between geology and sustainability. Could you connect those dots for me and listeners?
One of my pet insights is just simply looking at the landscape the way it used to be before we built cities there. And so a lot of the book I weave in the story of the original inhabitants, the Ohlones, and then I go back beyond that before there were even people around. So when I think of sustainability, those people, the Ohlones, everything they used was right there. And that's hard to imagine, but it's stimulating to imagine. How could we live more like that? It's a very hard problem, sustainability in modern civilization, because it's you say rocks. Well, we need plain old rocks. We need crushed stone, We need to get that from somewhere. But beyond that, we need resources. We need iron ore. We need metals. For centuries, we needed coal. We're giving up coal. We're giving up petroleum, but we still need all those other things, the metals, to build, the electric railroads and the solar panels and so on that we're going to need if we want to stop burning carbon. So sustainability is all about geology, and geology, it's I think the most important task for geologists these days. I didn't used to believe that, but it is today. We have to help the rest of the world get through this into the long-term future, a future that we can call Anthropocene,
Yeah. I want to move right into faults because this is something I think about quite a bit. I think people tend to just think about the biggest ones. I mean, most people know San Andreas Fault either through the film or through stuff that they've read. But you mentioned early in your chapter about faults that there's lots of faults all over the place. Can you talk about or distinguish active and inactive faults and then talk about the relationship between the San Andreas Fault and the Hayward Fault?
A geologist can scare people by talking about faults. They point out, here's a geologic map, and there's all these colored stripes and blobs and all these dark lines, and they say all those dark lines are faults. A fault is any crack, any large crack along which the sides have moved. So that could happen any time in the 4 billion years geologic past. But the active faults, yeah, they're moving today, but that's a very small fraction of what geologists call faults. And everyone knows the San Andreas. It runs almost through all of California, all the way up to Cape Mendocino. But it's more than just one fault. It's a whole belt of faults, because Earth is not a neat and tidy place. They're always shifting. The boundary between the North America and Pacific plates, which the San Andreas Fault represents, is actually quite wide. It stretches from the San Gregorio Fault, which runs offshore, to the Concord Fault, which runs about 30 miles, 20, 30 miles east of Oakland. And you can include the far side of the Sierra Nevada, along what's called the Walker Lane. That's moving too. The most of California is actually a separate block of the Earth's crust from the rest of North America. Now, we all know that socially, as a human society, California is a place apart, and geologically it is too. And I think it all it, you see it all in the landscape. California's landscape is pretty unique,
Well,
and that's what yeah.
there were so many interesting things in the chapter that I would want to talk about, but the kind of the first one that jumps out to me is somewhere that I haven't been, which is the Claremont Canyon. And you describe this distortion that exists there. Can you explain what that is? I haven't seen kind of the canyon itself, so I don't really have a visual of it necessarily to latch on to what you're referring to.
But well, you picture the fault. There's a big long crack in the ground, and the sides are moving with respect to each other, so that if you look across it, the other side is moving to the right. There are other faults that do it to the left in other parts of the world. Ours is a right lateral fault. And there is also a bit of pressure across the fault. That is, the North America side is moving west at the same time the whole thing is moving sideways. And that forces the hills up. And then the hills in turn push the bay down. That's why we have a basin in the San Francisco Bay and these whole range of hills on the east side of them. And so while the hills are rising, you've got streams running down from the hills, and they're cutting gulches, they're cutting canyons as the hills rise. As the hills rise, the streams cut harder. And so you have this effect along the front, and you see it all over the West. You see it in Nevada, you see it in Utah along the Wasatch Front. In Salt Lake City is the same. You'll go over to Google Maps and look at it. And there are these long ridges and then these canyons cutting right down to it. And they have these dramatic mouths, the openings, the canyons. And that's just what Clermont Canyon is like. And it's like most of the other canyons up and down the East Bay, but it's a very clear-cut example. It's a textbook quality canyon, what's called a wine glass canyon in that dynamic setting I described. You know, the upper part is still carving itself a nice round stream valley, but then the mouth of the canyon is quite narrow. And then below the canyon, it's spreading all this sediment out in a big fan. That's why we call it a wine glass canyon. And so that's the best picture I can give you. But really, the way to look at it is to go to Google Maps, go to Death Valley, and look at the sides of Death Valley, and you'll see the same thing there without any human overprint.
There was a device that you described in this chapter, which sounded like, when I read it first, like something you might take to a bar with you to protect yourself. It was a creep meter. And I was curious by it. And I was also curious just in terms of the effects of creep that an average person living in Oakland, what are they going to see that indicates that creep is going on?
The easiest thing to see is where the sidewalk curbs cross a creeping fault. As I say, the one side is moving to the right with respect to the other. And in the Montclair neighborhood and several other places that I've laid out in my blog and in the book, you can go there and you'll see the, if you look down the sidewalk, you'll see a bend to the right, just a few inches because it's not vast. A few millimeters a year. And your average sidewalk is a few decades old, so it's like a few inches. You have to look to see it. But here and there, you'll see it quite a clean offset. And on the blog, I show lots of examples for that. Another thing you'll see if you look at the asphalt on the road, you'll see these rugged sets of cracks. They're sort of like the If you stretch your pant leg, you see these parallel creases. And if you imagine the scissors cutting those creases, that's what they look like. They're called echelon cracks. And then if you go farther up, you get into Google Maps and you look at stream courses. Now, this is over a much longer period of geologic time. But when a stream, you know, tries to cross the fault and the other side keeps moving to the right, the stream gets bent there. And that's a pretty dramatic evidence of what faults do to the landscape. And we can see all those things in Oakland very clearly. You can see them all up and down the Bay Area. But of course, I was focusing on the one city because, you know, you go to geology school, you take a geology course, they show you examples from all over the world. You don't look in your own neighborhood for these things. I wanted us to see them in Oakland. So that was the whole thing in my book. And I was so pleased to realize that we have a whole textbook worth of things to see in Oakland, you know. I wish and I want some other, you know, equally gifted writer in their own city to start doing that same thing. I want a whole literature to arise around this subject.
Yeah, well, it's such a, I mean, the effect is that you just slow down. And I think so many of us get in our routines and our environment that we miss the little things. Like stopping to see an off-centered sidewalk is not something you're rushing through the city streets to jump on Muni and try, or BART, or get to work. You're not thinking about those things. But I love that as an effect of your book. Another thing that intrigued me in the fault chapter was a discussion of the 1868 earthquake. And in reading some of those headlines, I wondered if how hyperbolic some of those, they were talking about the streets rolling like waves. And I was trying to picture that. I know earthquakes can have very dramatic effects on the surface, but I was wondering, from your perspective, if those were hyperbolic or the descriptions that the newspapers had from that time were really describing what people were experiencing.
Those were real. And you hear it every day when you read earthquake stories, this week. That's what people see. That's what they saw then. Now, newspapers were more colorful in those days.
Yeah.
And writers were, it was a good time to be a newspaper writer. That was the main. People don't read papers anymore, darn it.
Yeah.
But everybody did then, and that was how it was the only media, basically. And so it rewarded colorful writing. Yeah, those stories are true. They have been reinforced every earthquake since then. We haven't seen them in Oakland since 1868 because that one was the Hayward Fault. It ruptured. The two sides moved apart by a couple of meters and cracked the ground. Hasn't happened since. The fault is ready to do that again. And the next time it does, the same thing will happen again because we'll be right on top of it.
Yeah.
And I dread it, but I'm going to have my eyes wide open too.
That was something that came a conclusion or a question I had at the end of the chapter is how present you should keep these things in mind. I mean, it's a terrifying possibility, but there's also somewhat uncertainty about when it's going to come. And I think we see this right now with especially Zoomers and younger generations that are focused on the catastrophic effects of climate change and how it can create this kind of mental unwellness in people that they fixate on it. So, from your perspective, how should the average Oaklander think about this prospect?
Yeah, they should think about it periodically. The same way you think about, if you're a homeowner, you think about, well, how's the roof doing? How are the trees doing? Do they need to care? You need to think about your earthquake preparation. You need to go, have I budgeted to get my foundation checked out? Do I need to do some more about my emergency supplies? Or if you're simply a concerned citizen, or what's my city council doing about it? And city officials need to do the same thing. City staffers need to do it, and citizens need to keep goosing them about that. Simply need to keep awareness going. On the other hand, we need to not be scared because we're not. We were all scared about the pandemic, but we've all learned what to do. And so we can't really say we're scared about that. We're scared about other things these days. We're scared about the wars. Climate change is scary because so much is still uncertain. In my book, I wanted to minimize the scary part. I wanted people to get to know the Hayward Fault while it's asleep. While it's still asleep, we should get to know it. Go on out there and look at the cracks, see exactly where it is. And when it does give way, and it may not in our lifetimes, people have bought mortgages for all these years, last 100 years, and each one of them is rolling the dice that they'll come out the other end ahead, and they've all won, So I think about it every day personally, just as a geologist. I make my rounds every morning, and one of my things I click on my browser is the USGS earthquake map. And I see little red dots all up and down the state. And there they are. That's what I do. I hope people will do that. Not because it's scary. It's just the same thing like looking out your window and seeing what the sky is doing.
We're going to switch gears now and talk about Lake Merritt, which I've had some nice walks, some nice jogs, but I guess lake is a misnomer, which I think I knew maybe deep down somewhere, but maybe didn't really know what it actually was. So what is Lake Merritt if it's not a lake?
Yeah, you know it's not a lake because it's full of seabirds, and it doesn't smell like a lake. It smells like the bay because it's actually an estuary. But what I get into in the book is the whole deeper story of Lake Merritt and why it's there. And that gets us into deep time, into the shallow end of deep time. And it was a lovely way to introduce a lot of subjects. And I was happy my book editor suggested those first three chapters because it's kind of you get your feet wet with Lake Merritt, and then you move, as you do through the rest of, you don't get into rocks until chapter 9 of 11, So if you think geology is a dry topic, you don't get to the rocks part. And by the time you do, I think it's probably, you're not scared anymore. But simply, for someone like you who visits Lake Merritt, knowing this, it just adds another layer of enjoyment to your experience. It gives you another handle on what you're looking at. It's like, the pandemic sent a lot of us home. We were all sitting around at home, and a lot of people got into baking. A lot of people got into bird watching because birds are everywhere. And I think my book has gotten such a good reaction for the same reason that a lot of us, people who used to work in offices, are spending a lot more time at home now. And they're taking walks around the neighborhood and they're looking around. And I'm there to serve them,
Yes. Can we talk about the history of dredging of Lake Merritt? And in the chapter, you discuss kind of, it seems like you're ambivalent in some ways, because at one point you do say, and I'm not going to quote you directly, that things have improved as it pertains to wildlife. And so in some ways, it's kind of a mixed bag with the history of dredging. Is that an accurate way to describe things?
Well, I would say we tend to rewrite our history as positively as possible. Let's put it that way. Lake Merritt was, when the city was founded, it was just a muddy slough. It was a mud bed and a marsh all around it, which was fine for the Ohlones, for the Indians, because it was good for their lifestyle. They hunted there and they fished there and they harvested plants there and so on. When the Americans arrived, they said, we don't want this. And so they changed it. And one of the first things they did was had the state pass a law that forbid hunting and fishing in Lake, specifically in Lake Merritt. That was a favor we had the state do for us. And so, but today you ask about that, and I say, oh yes. In 1870, that was the nation's first wildlife refuge. And I'm going, well, that's what we say today. That's not the way we talked about it back then. So yeah, you get a bit of sardonic feeling in the way I tell it. And that's simply just to reflect the fact that history changes with every generation, history changes. But what we see today feels like the best way it should be. Lake Merritt is a beautiful place. I have nothing bad to say about it. But the future of Lake Merritt will be different because the sea is rising.
That's what
It'll
I was going to
rise
ask
a
next. I
couple,
was going to
it's
ask.
rising. It's going to be a couple meters higher in 100 years. And what are we going to do? We'll have to think about it the
Yeah,
same
that's great.
way I would like us to think about the upcoming earthquake.
Yeah, I was going to
And
bring up
so it's
some.
and so you know it helps to think about the future when you look about the when you look at the past.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to bring up sea levels next. But I also wanted to latch on to something that you said in the chapter where you talked about Lake Merritt being a rare occurrence. And so kind of putting water levels in geological time, which is that things fluctuate. Lakes appear, lakes go away. Some it's human induced and some not. I live in the Central Valley. There's used to be the largest freshwater lake this west of the Mississippi.
I miss it. I wish it were back.
And I, you know, it actually, you know, in scare quotes, came back for a moment during the really inundated rain we had last year. And I had a friend of mine had a drone and he just kind of flew it over the top so you could see the expanse. And it was incredible. But then there's also the history of the way land rights were. And if you dredged land, that was new land that could be claimed. And so there's a complicated political, legal history here too. But can you explain a little bit more about what you mean when you say it's a rare occurrence, about over time how things fluctuate when it comes to lakes existing and lakes disappearing?
Well, there's two ways to answer that. One is that in geology in general, geology does its work in bursts. You know, a major rainstorm will flood a stream and it'll move all the big stuff around. You go back and it'll wash out bridges, and earthquakes, you know, earthquakes build mountains. They don't just sort of grow, they happen in lurches, you know. So in that respect, yeah, geology is a series of rare events that are repeated over a million years. And in terms of Lake Merritt, well, in the last million years, this is a whole different thing. In the last couple million years, the Earth has been going through ice ages. It's gone through almost 50 of them. There wasn't just one. And each one, you know, the ice caps grow, they suck water out of the ocean subsides, the sea level goes down, and then they come back. Sometimes the ocean rises even higher than today. And so that aspect of geologic history, not the tectonic part, the part that involves the Hayward Fault and so on, that up and down ice age history, was a whole separate part of Oakland that I was overjoyed to learn about. I didn't really know about it when I set out to learn about Oakland. I thought that was a kind of an East Coast thing where I went to college, you know, I was used to that. So anyway, to make a long story short, Lake Merritt is really quite temporary in that longer term respect. It's only there for just a finger snap of time when you look at a million-year scale. So I thought that's a kind of precious thing to realize. I added a sentence, but it may have been the last sentence I added to the book. I said, nothing is temporary to a geologist. And that's part of the way I look at things, you know.
Let's talk about the shoreline a little bit. I like walking along the bay, like a lot of people are having lunch and looking at it, but it's very different than it used to be. So can you talk a little bit about the shoreline that was the shoreline of the Ohlone and then what we see today?
Well, it's hard to picture the natural shoreline because there's so little of it left.
Yeah.
You know, wherever you go.
Can we make deductions based on the shoreline that's similar, if that makes sense?
There are some preserves. You can go to the Delta. There are parts of the Sacramento San Joaquin Delta that look the same as they used to, just little bits. And there are a few preserves along the coast. If you're a bird watcher, you know, if you want to watch the great migrations, talk to those people. They'll tell you where to go. If you want to see the vernal pools in the Great Valley, those are kind of like the way they used to be. But the San Francisco Bay was just a gigantic marsh for the most part. There were very few decent anchorages there. There were very few beaches, you know. It was not like the Pacific coast. But Europeans didn't care about that. You know, the marsh meant nothing to them, except at first, you know, the duck hunters that got shooed out of Lake Merritt by that law in 1870. The duck hunters had a bonanza for a long time. They would go out during the gold rush and fill their rowboats with ducks, and then row back and sell them for a buck a piece in 1850 gold dollars, So they kind of wiped out the ducks pretty fast. And then after that, the movers and shakers, the people with the gold, said, "All right, let's start building harbors. Let's start building cities. Let's start building railroads. Let's get rid of this marsh and turn it into land we can put factories on," and so on and so on and so on. And that's a story all over California. That's the story of Tulare Lake. They said, let's drain it, turn it into productive farmland. That's what happened to the Delta. That's what happened to the gold country. It was all, let's wash it all out and just sift all the gold out of it. And it's tragic, but it's what Americans do. Americans do it better and worse than everybody else in the world. We're kind of exceptional that way. And and this kind of sardonic tone, yeah, it creeps into my prose. It does.
It's hard. I'm sure it's hard, not hard to avoid it. So, in a similar way to our last section about faults, and we're thinking about rising sea levels and the world changing, how should Oaklanders think about their shoreline? What do you project using your crystal ball? Is going to change as sea levels rise.
Well, for one thing, in the 60s, we stopped filling in the bay. We stopped doing all the bad things for the most part, and we started doing better things. And so a lot of the San Francisco Bay wetlands that were turned into salt ponds are being returned to the proper marsh. And that's a really great development because we can get salt other ways. We mine it from underground beds now, just like, we always advance. Before we learned about oil and gas, before we learned about coal, we were cutting all the trees down everywhere we went because you needed firewood. You needed firewood to run locomotives. You needed wood. You needed charcoal to do blacksmithing, And so we were terrible destroyers of forests. And so now we're growing forests back. On the other hand, we're not maintaining them the way the Ohlones did, which was to burn them regularly at the best time of year to do so. So we need to relearn those things. But as far as the shoreline goes, like I say, the great big salt beds in the South Bay, we're turning them back into wetlands. In the North Bay, they were diked off and turned into hay fields. Those are being returned to wetlands. Now in Oakland itself, we've turned those wetlands into airports. We've turned them into seaports. We've turned them into residential neighborhoods. Those are harder problems. As the sea rises, some of those housing developments they're going to give up. The airport will probably pile a few more feet of sand and gravel on top and build it up. The harbor, we'll build it up, we'll dredge it down. And then there will be parts, and there are parts, small parts, that we're letting return to wetland. And we can bulldoze them and shape them and, make them approximate natural landforms. And the plants and wildlife seem to like that just fine. So those are good things we're doing, and we're going to have to do a lot more of them. And our governments are going to have to plan for it. They're going to have to issue bonds and make laws and, to settle all the court cases. And it's going to be costly, but not doing it will be even worse.
Yeah. So there will be some reclamation to reinforce things that are necessary, and then some adaptation to things that, are maybe unavoidable, is what you're saying.
Yeah, it's going to be a difficult balance, but we will definitely need geologists to inform us what we're doing wrong and right from our viewpoint,
Okay.
which is the Earth's viewpoint.
Yeah. All right, one more topic before we get to books to close up. I want to talk about, we've talked about fault lines, we've talked about Lake Merritt, we've talked about the bay, but I want to close by talking about one of the most distinctive things that you see when you're in Oakland, which is the beautiful Oakland Hills. I mean, it's something that, you know, if you're in, you just, your eye is naturally drawn to the ridgeline there. And if you can go up there, I mean, I've never lived in the Oakland Hills, but I've been to houses in the Oakland Hills. It's one of the most tranquil places that I've ever been. And what makes it interesting and distinct is that it has a different shape than a lot of other mountain ranges. I guess you, would you call it a mountain range? I mean, the hills there, is that, how would you classify it? I guess I don't really know the correct terms here.
Yeah. Technically, there are not mountains. A mountain is 600 meters high. That's about 2,000 feet. And our highest points are a little less than that.
So can you talk about the formation of them? It was a very interesting section in your book when you were talking about how they were
Well,
formed.
You know, like I explained at the beginning, they're being pushed up by forces across the Hayward Fault. That's actually the story of the whole Coast Range. And when you learn to see the Coast Range that way, they have this sort of sideways look to them. You see it very dramatically in places like the Carrizo Plain, where there's really no people, just the San Andreas Fault. And you look at all the stream valleys coming down and they all bent over, you know, because the fault is distorting the land. But, you know, every city in California has a view of the mountains. Every town in California, that's a cool thing about California. There's mountains everywhere in California. And they're all different. The Sierra is different from, and then the Far East California mountains are different. The Mojave Mountains are different. The Klamaths, and then the volcanoes in the Northeast, they're all different. It's a wonderful place to do geology. But the Coast Range has its own peculiar look. And that's, I thought the Oakland Hills are a really good example of that. That you need to, I wanted to point that out to people so that they would notice that. And they would recognize it elsewhere.
One of the tools, my mental tools that comes into my brain a lot is systems thinking or systems theory, input, output, stocks, flows. And when I was reading your sections about landslides and tectonic, well, the balance that goes on in Oakland Hills with destruction and creation. And I guess the question I'm trying to ask here is, how do you see the balance between those two forces playing out? Can you explain kind of how that process works?
Well, it's kind of like the way I spoke about the science of geology these days is about processes and the forces that shape the landscape. And when a geologist looks at a mountain range, a range of hills, they see a temporary thing. It's a temporary, it's there's a balance between erosion and uplift. And what is uplifting them? Well, that's an interesting question. And what is eroding them? Well, we know about that, rainfall mostly, and landslides. Landslides do the hard work, and then rainfall does the gentle work. And if you kind of roll the landscape forward 1,000 years at a frame and look at the landscape as a movie, you see mountain ranges that are more like the surf on the ocean, you know. And so I a couple different places in the book, I liken the hills to a wave, because it looks like that. The Oakland Hills look like a great big wave. And if you're a cosmic surfer on a million-year scale, you could be surfing on that wave. And, you know, Oakland is also a great cannabis town. And if you, a lot of people, it's an enjoyable place to look at. And so I wanted to use that simile for those people too.
Well, I want to connect this to California history. That is mm-hmm. the podcast here. And some of my favorite works of history tend to be interdisciplinary, not just pulling on one discipline's strings. They pull on many to kind of make a tapestry that connects different viewpoints in one carpet, if you will. And I'm curious if you were at, let's say, some kind of interdisciplinary conference and you met maybe a traditional academic historian that tends to focus on things like newspapers and primary sources that are written. And they said, well, what do you think the benefit would be for me investing time into understanding the geology of a place? How would that inform what I do as an academic historian? What would you say to them?
They probably already know geography, like the suitability of a harbor, the presence of rivers and floods, and plateaus, trade routes. That there are geologic things behind that, but I would think mostly it would be about the response of civilizations to earthquakes. That's deep history. And the availability of the different cycles of prospecting and ore production and mining. Those all things have a geological connection. I do think geologists would have a lot more fun if they looked into human history. And of course, some of them do. I have to tell you, I had the most fun writing this book, looking into the human history. And of course, part of the time it was during the pandemic, the libraries were closed, but I had a subscription to newspapers.com, which is something that, the last generation of historians had to just go to the library and page through all that stuff at themselves. And it's amazing. It's an amazing resource. And I'm sure historians feel the same way. It was a lot of fun to go through the newspapers. I felt like I was going the old, there are histories of Oakland, there are histories of California. I felt like I was going those people, like Kevin Starr and so on. I was going one better, I've actually felt like I was uncovering things that they'd missed. So it's an
Absolutely.
exciting time for historians. And I hope they'll look into geology. I think the books are ready to be revised.
Last question before I ask you for some book recommendations. How has writing this book and the research you conducted changed your view of Oakland as a city?
I just love it more. I just see more. I saw part of the preparation, just for after I lived here for a while, I decided, got it into my head that I would walk every street. And I did that. I walked every street in Oakland, every block, both sides of the street. And I figured, well, at this point, I know every part of Oakland. I know all the neighborhoods. You can see the patterns of housing. You can see where the old things are and where things have fallen apart and need rebuilding and so on and so on. I got a good visceral sense of the human history at that point. And then I started reading the books, and that showed me even more. And then finally, I put it together with the geology, and I realized, oh, this landform is where all the developers put their high-end housing. How did that happen? How did they intersect with the patterns of the railroad barons, and then the decline and fall of mass transit and the rise of the automobile? Those all intersected with our landscape. And so I thought, well, each of those people, each of those neighborhoods should know that about their neighborhood. This is, the ground they're living on has a story underneath it. And it was just a joy to weave all those threads together in one thing. That's why I would love other authors to do that. My publisher said, when this book was so successful, and it is, it was a bestseller. It is in the running for a California Book Award in its category. It's a success by any measure. But my publisher said, well, how about writing after you've done Deep Oakland, how about Deep LA? And I said, well, I'll think about it, but I'm just not going to do it. I don't want to be that. I'm 70 years old. I'm not going to start that franchise. I'm too old to do that. But I would love, it's a great idea.
Well, I think someone should do it that has a deep attachment like you, right?
Yeah.
Someone that lives there, right? And that's a
Some
part of the daily life.
they should do it in Fresno, you know. They could tell the story of Tulare Lake. They could tell the story of those underground houses in Fresno, which I haven't yet visited. You know, I like going there, but I haven't seen those yet. And the whole story of the mountains, the Sierra Nevada, and so on. There's great stories to be told in Fresno too.
Well, and I think this is something that's come up again and again on this podcast, and this is a regional podcast. You know, we're focused on a specific place, but I often find that municipal histories have been kind of isolated in a, trying to think of the nice word for it, local historical societies, kind of produce a lot of them, and they're
Yeah,
not treated.
it's about prominent families mostly. You know what I mean?
So I'm hoping that there's a new generation in this kind of increased focus on localism. I'm hoping that there's a new generation of writers that create the things that you're describing, because I think people really are, and I don't know if this is a COVID factor or if there's a larger thing here, the kind of hangover of globalization and, the kind of homogenization of cultures maybe leads to people kind of a pendulum effect that we want to get more local. And I think that's happening. I feel it in the stuff that I'm reading, whether it's local journalism or local writers. But we could go on this forever. I want to close with book recommendations. What are a few books, either on the topics that we've talked about today or other topics, that you'd like to recommend to listeners?
I think the standard histories of California are all good reading. You know, Kevin Starr's books. Philip Fredkin wrote a wonderful book called The Seven States of California. That was published in 1999. That's a good, he's very aware of geology and history, geography too. From the geological side, of course, we have John McPhee, who wrote Assembling California. That's a good high-level approach to California geology. Keith Meldahl has written a couple of very good books. One was called Hard Road West. It covers the old wagon routes, the before the gold rush, the wagon train routes across the Rockies into California. And another one called did a follow-up that's more about California. So there are those. And there are, for instance, in Oakland, we have a local architectural historian wrote an interesting book about all the mistakes that Oakland's governments have made over the years. It's called Hella Town, because
Yeah,
Oakland
we
is a
had him on
hella
the
town, you
podcast.
know?
Mitchell Schwartzer, we had him on the podcast.
Did
That
you?
was a
Did you?
great
Yeah,
conversation.
it is a good book, and another look at your local history, and so those I recommend,
Fantastic.
and of course San Francisco has got its own whole literature, the
Yeah,
same
that's a
thing.
whole nother library, right? Well, to close, what are you working on next?
What I'm working on now is like I said, I'm in my 70s. It's time to think about what's next. And I've been looking at all the rocks I've collected over the years for one reason or another. And all those reasons have changed. And I've decided a few years ago to start putting them back. I'm going to put them back where I collected them. And that has a couple of different benefits. One, I clear out my space. You know, I could turn my camera on and show you some of them. I'm actually getting bare shelves now. So that's one benefit. The other is that I get to go back to these very interesting places and see them again one more time, maybe at a better time of year, you know. And it's very stimulating. And I'm writing stuff down, I'm taking lots of notes, and that may turn into a book. That's what I'm doing. It's a
Well,
great idea. It's a good project.
it sounds fantastic. Andrew, thank you for the book and the research you've done, and its an impact on getting people to look more closely at their physical environment. It's totally invaluable, and I really appreciate what you're up to.
Thank you. It's been a great hour.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.